This is tape number one of an interview being conducted by Christopher Garofalo, G-A-R-O-F-A-L-O, UMass Medical School class of 1998. I am interviewing Dr. Burt Guterman, B-U-R-T-E, G-U-T-E-R-M-A-N, for the Worcester District Medical Society Spoken History Project. This interview is being conducted on Tuesday, August 15th, in the morning.
I have one too, but this is not for us, my patients.
Right. Okay.
Talks into it. Well, let's see. I was born in Worcester, 1918. Probably don't even know that. Memorial Hospital.
Okay.
And I went to school here in Worcester, and then I went to Clark University for undergraduate work. And following that, I went to Washington University in St. Louis Medical School. To begin with, Clark provided me with what I've always felt has been an excellent background, enjoyed it, and since it helped me make my career, so to speak, I'm very supportive of the school, and I do a lot of volunteer fundraising. I don't know if you want things of
this. No, this, yeah, this is fine.
I've been chairman of what's called the Jonas Clark Fellows, which has to do with people that give $1,000 a year to the school. Okay. So I've been in charge of that all over the country, and I think education is sort of the backbone of this society. And if we're going to survive, it's going to have to come from school.
Sure.
Anyway, then I went on to medical school, and that was quite an interesting experience because the Midwest is quite different from the East.
How so?
Mostly in pronunciation. When I would say Clark University or park your car, I would get ribbing all the time.
Yeah, I spent 4 months in Florida undergraduate, so I know what that's like.
And the people in the Midwest, at least the ones I had cut, were much warmer than the people here. They're different, but that's neither here nor there. Washington University, from my experience there, was probably one of the best experiences of my life, certainly education-wise. It's one of the best schools in the country, and it teaches something which is, I think, unusual. You know, as you know, since you're a medical student, there's a tremendous amount of material you have to learn at school. But Washington University has an approach in which that's not the main objective. The main objective is to teach you what to do with this. In other words, it teaches you, or the school does, to think, and that's the way it's oriented.
This was when you were there?
Yes.
As well, okay.
Which I found quite different than other places, because I've been other places. After I left there, I went to New Haven for my psychiatric residency, and I was very disappointed in this sense. in medical school, we had five Nobel Prize winners, not only the faculty, they used to work with us in physiology and pharmacology. So I got used to the idea that that's the way it was with every medical school.
That must have been quite an experience.
Sure. I would say so. And then when I got to New Haven, there weren't any. Now, New Haven is Yale is a very good school. So I assumed something that was incorrect. And the training there was very good, and it's part of the medical school. When I was in medical school, and I got interested in EEG work, brainwave. And so when I got to New Haven, in addition to my residency, the EEG department was in the same building, so the chief of the department let me work an hour there every day, provided I did my work. So I had a background, so to speak, in two areas, and in the 40s. Then I went into the service the first time, and I was assigned to a neurology service, of all things, after a psychiatric residency.
How did you get interested in psychiatry?
Well, when I applied to medical school, you know, they ask you, I don't know if they still do, write a little essay. So what I wrote in the essay was really quite simple. I said, I want to go to medical school so I can become a psychiatrist, period. That was it. My mother said to me when she heard that I was going into psychiatry, she couldn't believe it. Well, you probably are not familiar. In Worcester, there's a state hospital near the medical school, but there used to be a branch of the state hospital on Summer Street. You know where the main post office is on Summer Street?
Mm-hmm.
That whole hill was a state hospital, and there they kept the chronic, usually schizophrenic patients. And we lived within a quarter to a half a mile, and that was her conception of psychiatry. So how did I decide on this? I don't know. You know, in retrospect, kind of the foggiest idea, but something, perhaps radar, guided me.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a Freudian, you might have a better idea. And but in the service, I was on neurology service and doing EEG also. And I was very fortunate to get good assignments. When I got out of the service, I came back to Worcester and opened a private practice of psychiatry. But also, since I was already doing EEG work for 4 years, I wanted to do that, but there weren't any installations in the hospital. And I approached every hospital in the city. None of them wanted to have anything to do with it. So what we did, we set up a lab in the office. And my wife, who had already learned how to do the behavior, was the technician. So that's how we started that. In 1949, I applied for my boards, familiar with those, and they told me that I couldn't take the exam because I didn't have an internship.
Oh, really?
What happened was, see, things have changed. You used to have to have a rotating internship before your residency training, but when I was training, it was in the middle of the war, so they changed the rules. I had a letter from the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology saying that the internship and residency that I took at Yale would qualify me for the exam. I had a letter. So when I applied, they said, you can't take this exam until you do a rotating internship. So I sent them a letter, which I had kept. And too bad.
Oh, no.
So that was thrown out the window. So I already had an office in a private practice. So I took a 1 year rotating residency at Hahnemann up here for 1 year. And I was doing mostly surgery. Well, that was to make me able to take the exam.
Oh, sure.
And in the meantime, a few afternoons a week, I used to come to the office.
Was your practice a solo practice, or could you describe how you set that all up?
Yeah, it was private practice, all alone. You know, it had coverage from other psychiatrists, because you just can't be around 24 hours a day, and so forth. But there were other psychiatrists doing the same kind of thing. Originally, there weren't any psychiatric beds in the city. So we used to take our patients up to Hahnemann on the medical floor, unbeknownst, I guess this will go in the, to the staff. And so that went on for a while. Anyway, then I finally took my board exam and fortunately passed the first time. In 1952, I got word from the United States Army that I and I think 2,700 other doctors were being recalled who what reason that it was because of a technicality in the law. I was not in the reserve. I never got any comp, you know, I didn't pay for my schooling.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back reluctantly, to put it mildly. And
what happened with the practice at that point?
Nothing. I wasn't here, but my wife was here, so she used to do EEGs and used to send them by mail because I was down in Pennsylvania. And this is off what the, I was going to say off the record, I'm sort of joking. I used to come home most every weekend. So you might ask, how can you do that in the service? Well, the way it worked was I had better qualifications and training than the chief of the department. But I asked him, I'd like to go home every weekend to go. So anyway, that, you know, that's insignificant as far as what you're
interested in. Oh, no, not at all.
Anyway, finally, the law was changed, and those of us who were hauled in for the second time, and I think really by mistake, we were let go. By that time, several things had happened. St. Vincent Hospital decided to open an EEG lab, and they asked me to organize it. So I got sent a nun, you know, there used to be a lot of nuns up at St. Vincent,
sure,
to Children's Hospital for training as a technician. And I set up the lab, started doing that. At the same time, St. Vincent built that new building, which is not new
anymore,
with a psychiatric inpatient. This is the first psychiatric inpatient unit in New England, and with 50 beds. And anyway, that progressed, and then shortly afterwards, I think in 1954, Memorial Hospital, you know, it's a med center, but I call it Memorial. It's like monkey see, monkey do. They said, well, we'd like to have an EEG department. So I set up one up there. And then I was in private practice, was mostly seeing psychiatric patients, but also because of the EEG work, excuse me, I saw a lot of epileptic patients. And some of my training from that point of view, because that's neurological, was with Dr. Margaret Lennox and William Lennox. You probably never heard of them. They, just by chance, probably Dr. William Lennox, the father, is probably known internationally as the father of epilepsy.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
Known all over the world. Oh, here is his books.
It's two volumes.
Oh.
He was at, when I met him, he was at the Children's Hospital, and I used to go there one day a week,
mm-hmm,
to learn about EEGs and epilepsy, because I was doing quite a bit of that. So I was fortunate to, you know, have that experience of contact. And what we used to do, even though I was in private practice with hospital patients, we had a group, it's a loose arrangement of about six psychiatrists who would cover for each other, like if you want to go away for a weekend or vacation or whatever. And you could sign out and so forth, and you had to provide the coverage, but each one functioned independently.
So sort of a group practice with just much
with
looser.
With no walls.
Right, okay.
Which is very difficult to do now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know of many, well, some, but I don't think many, a small percentage nowadays of physicians are going into individual practice. Most seem oriented for working for a group, like the Fallon Clinic, or any sort of a group. And my feeling is, I'm not sure, you probably know more about it than I, but, doctors coming out of medical school and finishing training and so forth are not interested anymore in spending the working the number of hours
many hours did you used to work? How was that for you?
Endless.
Yeah.
It's not 40 hours a week. But, you know, most, and I have the advantage in a sense of speaking to some before they even go to school because I interviewed for the school. Most seem more interested in getting a job with a group which provides, you know, regular salary, insurance, and health benefits, and so forth, plus working 40 hours a week. You see more of that than ever before. It's just very difficult nowadays to function otherwise. So I think what I've been doing is I've been in practice 48 years, I think.
Wow. That's very impressive.
Well, it's impressive just to stay alive.
Yeah.
But and people say, well, what do you keep working for? Well, first of all, I don't work, you know, the way I used to, hours-wise. But I like to work, and I have plenty of time to do all the things, or the other things that I like to do.
Such as?
Well, I'm tennis addict.
Oh.
So I always play 3-4 times a week. I go to Florida for 2 months in the winter, and my wife and I go to a tennis resort. And
Nick Bollettieri, or
pardon?
Nick Bollettieri, or
oh no, I'm not. But he's in Bradenton.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with him.
Yep.
Are you a tennis player?
Yeah. Yes.
Good.
Not as good as I'd like to be. I don't play as much as I would like to.
Did you play, you know, on the school team?
No. I mean, I played through high school, but never on the team. I never had time to play on the. To devote that amount of time, I had to work, but...
Neither did I. I started playing tennis when I was 50 years old. I never played
tennis. Oh, really?
Like you, I never had time.
Oh.
So I'm middle aged. But I hit it happens. My son is a... he's in business, but he's a pro, a registered pro. So I used to play a lot of competitive tennis with him.
Oh, yeah.
So it's father-son tournaments. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
So in the 1970s, when I was just learning in America, he and I used to play all over the world.
Oh, wow. That must have been a lot of fun.
Well, it was, you know, one of the, since I'm really not an athlete, you know, not, I can play it like an average middle-aged player, but that was one of the most nicest periods of, you know, family life, so to speak. So, but we don't play anymore together.
Oh, really?
Well, he's so busy with his work.
Oh.
And don't forget, I'm 20 years older.
Mm.
In case you don't know it, as you get older, everything doesn't work.
Right.
You know, physically.
Was it tough having a practice or... you know, it sounds like both you and your wife working at the practice. How was that on your family life and your children?
Well, I don't think it was as difficult as most doctors have. I always felt that, you know, from a work point of view, that I wasn't in it to straighten out the whole world. And so I'm not going to work 80 or 100 hours a week. I used to schedule, and you can do it more in psychiatry than you can in other specialties, and regulate it so that I was home, you know, the end of the day. So we all ate meals together and make sure to take vacation every year, you know, with the children. And so I think probably it was less stressful than most doctors do, partly because of the specialty I was in, but partly because that's the way I felt it's better. Because, you know, you often hear this question of doctors, they're married to their work, not to their spouses,
right?
And this can create a conflict.
I'm sure, yeah, I'm sure. In your specialty, you probably see that quite a bit, and you see the consequences of that.
Obviously, through the years, certain things have changed, and I'm sure you're familiar with
example, the number of physicians. The number of physicians that you hear about nowadays with substance abuse, alcohol, drugs, and so forth, much greater than it ever used to be.
Is it much greater now, do you think, or do you think it's much more out in the open?
I don't know.
Okay.
You hear about it more. Was it more or less? I really don't know. I can't answer that question, but even the medical society, as you know, does much more about it. Mm-hmm. They're making facilities available, and your doctors are human beings, and they're subject to the same foibles that the rest of the world is. That's a good question. I don't really know, Chris, the answer, whether there's more of it or less of it. Maybe that'll be something for you to figure out.
Yeah.
During your, that would be an interesting study anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It does, you know, talking about that, in the 1950s, this is connected with doctors, but more general.
Yeah.
One of the insurance companies did a study of what happens when doctors die, and they talk about finances. I don't know if you're aware, but somewhere in the neighborhood of one-third were in bankruptcy.
Really?
That's correct.
Wow.
Now, isn't that strange?
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what the figures are now, but I'm sure they're much less for a variety of reasons. One of them being, you know, Social Security.
Right.
It's sort of a network that catches them. But are you aware that the medical society has, I don't know what it is because I send them money every year, a committee that helps doctors, you know, who are either disabled or who have retired and are having financial problems?
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
I can't remember the name. I get the bill every year, but I don't know. But I think in general, the number of doctors running into financial problems, you know, at the end of their life, so is less. One of the reasons, I think, is doctors are more aware of finances and practical matters than they used to be. But generally, people say doctors are poor businessmen.
Hmm.
I don't know what you have gone far enough to have that to know.
No, I do know. I used to do research, actually, during my undergraduate. I used to work with an ophthalmologist, and he was a very good businessman. He was very much into developing drugs used for allergies, ocular allergies, and you know, he had a lot of people around him, you know, lawyers and business people to work and help run his office and stuff. But he was, I mean, you know, just absolutely fabulous, I thought, in dealing with the business side, which I remember thinking was a little bit strange, because I kind of had the conception that you just stated, that, you know, most doctors want to practice medicine and they'd rather leave the business to other people. But, you know, here's this guy that was totally flying in the face of that, so I found that to be very interesting.
Well, he's the exception. Not the rule. I know, I get calls every day, you know, from brokers or investment counselors or one thing or other. Everybody wants to make money for you.
Mm-hmm.
And
themselves.
Exactly. And so as I say to them, you don't even know me. What are you calling me for? I'm not interested in making any money. I'm beyond that now. I'm too old to make any difference. And I'm not interested in taking it along with me.
Right, right.
I want to give it away, which I do.
Mm-hmm.
So my wife and I do. Anyway. So let's see, what are... Well, now, I still work, but I have limited hours, and I take a lot of time off.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm able to do whatever I wish. The world of medicine has changed. I don't have to tell you that.
No.
And I'm not happy in the way it's changing, and I'm not happy in the way the medical society, I don't mean the Worcester, but the AMA, I'm a member, but I don't think their whole approach to all of this is the best. They're a very conservative group. I don't know if you're aware of that.
Yeah, I mean, I get that feeling. How do you feel that the medical field has changed? I know there are so many different ways, so if you just want to pick one or two, or I mean, you know, if you want to limit it to, say, psychiatry, you know, how has the practice of psychiatry changed? Or?
Well, first, in general, I feel right now one of the biggest problems is that legislators and insurance companies are making medical decisions which should be made by doctors.
And that used to be made by doctors?
Yes. Recently, well, within the last month, a bill was introduced in Boston legislature by Harriet Chandler and Lois Pines. I don't know if you know them, they're legislators.
Mm-hmm.
About maternity.
Yes, I heard about
48-hour, you know, increasing so they wouldn't just throw you out of
right.
the hospital. And while I agree, I think it's a good thing medically, why should they be deciding that? They're not doctors.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors should be deciding that. The way all the, for example, the different insurance companies, incidentally, you know how many insurance companies service Worcester?
No.
Over 30.
Really?
Someone at the medical school counted them all up. And it's incredible.
Wow.
And some of the things that I think represent deficiencies in medical care, number one, patients can't go to whatever doctor they wish. You're aware of that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Depending on what plan they belong to and what plan the doctor belongs to. And secondly, doctors can't belong to every plan that they wish.
Oh, right.
Are you aware of that?
I am. I mean, I've heard about some probably pretty high-profile cases where doctors were actually kicked out of, you know, certain groups because they didn't meet certain bottom lines or something. So I am, in that sense, aware that you cannot belong to any group that you want to.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Well, first of all, the information is not correct. That's the worst part. You chose not to participate. That's not true. I asked to participate.
Mm-hmm.
They wouldn't let me in. Why wouldn't they let me in? Because I'm on the consulting staff, not on the active staff.
Okay. They don't like that, or they
do? They don't like it. That's it. They make the rules. I'm not sure whether this is legal or not, but how would you like to be in business? You know, for example,
right.
And somebody says to you, you can't sell, or you can't have X, Y, and Z as customers. You know, essentially, it's, I think, a restraint of trade.
Mm-hmm. Is this, what was it like when you first started practicing? You know, say the first 5-10 years
well,
of practice?
Well, at the beginning, it was fee for service. You know, you would charge patients when they saw you, and you would bill them.
What if they couldn't afford it?
Then you do what you wish. I would just usually see them anyway and forget it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I've... A lot of doctors use collection services.
Mm-hmm.
May or may not know. I don't think I've ever used one. Because, you know, it's a small percentage, and the people... There are some people that just can't afford it. So, that fee for service has changed with the advent of all the insurance companies. Same thing, I remember with the psychiatric unit, when we opened that, there was no inpatient coverage to begin with. And then after a year or so, Blue Shield covered for 10 days. That's in a lifetime. And then they gradually started increasing it until, I don't know what it was at the end, like 60 days per year or some such thing. So it was very remunerative, and it was much easier. There was no restriction on who could belong, both patient and doctor-wise. But now there's extreme. In the, for example, with doctors, it's determined as to whether you can be, like, say, HMO Blue. It has nothing to do with your credentials.
Okay. What does it depend on?
Good question. See, they won't let me in. That's another thing. They won't let me into HMO Blue. Of course, I'm not that interested because I'm near the end of my career. So if I wanted to make a fuss, I could probably, maybe could get in. What does it depend on? I've called more than once to try to get an answer to that, but they won't answer. But I know what the reason is. The reason is, in a panel, say HMO Blue, they will allow X number of psychiatrists, say 10, 20 in the state. Once that number is reached, no more can join. Do you have any idea why that should be?
No.
Well, I think it's very simple. The less doctors they have on the panel, the less claims they're going to get. So it's cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, patients will be covered by some other insurance through some other doctor. That's one of the most distressing things about the whole field of medicine is now big business. And the decisions, as I said, medical decisions are being made by legislatures and insurance companies, not by doctors. And I find that to very distressing.
Do you feel that medicine, here's two questions, can be run like a business, and do you feel it should be run like a big business?
When you say medicine, I'm not sure what you're referring to.
Like you just said, that medicine is now being run more like a business, with the dollar being the bottom line. I guess the question comes down to, do you feel that medicine can continue going in the way it's going and survive in that manner? Or, comparing a fee-for-service model versus, what they have now, the HMOs and the PPOs.
I don't pretend to know all the answers. I just know what my own experience has been. And can it survive? Well, of course, medicine will survive. It always has, in one form or another. But where the bottom line is the most important thing, and it is, that, cost-cutting, saving money, and so forth. But unfortunately, it has an effect on medical decisions. And I don't have to tell you what things you read about, some of the terrible things that have happened in different hospitals, deaths and so forth, accidents, some of which is attributed to this whole procedure. Perhaps another, way to look at it is maybe in this country we can't afford to have the kind of medical care that we'd like. Can't have everything. Or put it another way, the country doesn't want to spend the kind of money that would provide all that. I feel a little concerned about younger people, like yourself, for example, in the sense, you're not faced with it because you're a UMass, but say you went to a private school. It's not unusual to end up out of medical school, owing $100,000 to $200,000, where are you going to get the money to pay for it? And I say this only in the sense that the income of doctors generally has reached a ceiling and it's headed down. What I'm saying is not anything that you can't find out about by reading the newspaper. And I think this puts a lot of stress on younger people. Are you aware of some of this?
Not too much. I mean, being at UMass, because again, a lot of that financial burden is kind of taken off of you. I have some friends who are at other medical schools who, are paying the $30,000, $40,000 a year, and we only talk about it in cursory manner because they're in their first year, so it's kind of like, well, yeah, it's on my mind, but I'll deal with that later.
But, I mean, I can't imagine that that does not influence, you know, their decision into what field to practice, possibly, you know, which may be good. But on the other hand, too, I mean, yeah, I mean, they are pretty uncertain, you know, and we're all, I mean, I think even people who are not totally worried about the money aspect are a little concerned about, you know, am I going to have a job when I get out? You know, will there be positions for me where I want to go? You know, in Massachusetts,
oh,
you know, can I stay here? You know, will I have to go to somewhere, you know, like Nebraska or something, you know, where there is probably more opportunities for physicians? So I think in that sense that that's something that I think a lot of my classmates are looking at, irrespective of, you know, owing, you know, having
right.
to pay back that amount of money. I think that when you've got that financial burden on you, I think that just makes it all the more imperative, you know, and all the more how much you think about it. And how much it weighs on your mind.
Well, it's a reality, unfortunately. And I'm concerned that's, well, I have always felt since, you know, while I was in residency, getting $0 per month, can you imagine that?
No.
Second year, I was getting $25 a month. Room and board, or they did your laundry.
Oh, wow.
I got meals. And I said, I vowed that if I ever got through all this, that I hopefully could do something to alleviate some of it. That's why we started this scholarship.
Oh, right.
Thing. I've been chairman for 25 years. And after 25 years, last year I asked Dr. Danford, I don't know if you know him, he's a radiologist, to take over, but I'm still on the committee. And that's so we can help some students. It's tough.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's good that, you know, that that's being recognized and helping
the
them out.
You know, I don't know if you're even aware, we provide the Medical Society, because the school is part of the Medical Society. We provide UMass with an equal amount of money.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
We get support from the doctors there. And, you know, the medical society involves not only the community, but the medical school. This year, we provided them with $30,000 for loans and three scholarships, as those are free, of $3,000 each. It's
$9,000. Oh, wow.
So, apparently you're not involved in that, so you must be reasonably affluent.
Oh, no, not at all. I just didn't realize that that money came from the society specifically.
Oh, yeah. Have you ever asked for money?
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Starting year one. Undergraduate.
I've forgotten who's running it now. The person that in financial aid.
Judy Case?
Yeah, Judy. I have to speak to her all the time. Bring the papers down. Anyway, she knows this. And I don't know how she decides who. I don't know if you get any help from the school.
Oh, yeah.
Well, some of it may be from the, from this fund. As a matter of fact, we finally convinced, you know, the Fallon Clinic, you heard of them.
Mm-hmm.
They now give an annual scholarship at UMass for a student who's be going into primary care, $3,000.
Oh, really? Oh, I didn't know that.
And there were two other scholarships that they give. You know, you can speak to Judy. Well, she knows. You know, she takes everybody and they try to see who needs it most.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think kind of once I send in the application, I think it, you know, they pretty much decide where the money comes from.
We turn them, that half of this money that we give away every year, here, Judy, you take it and you disperse it. But we, for students in private schools, we do our own. That's why we had the meeting this morning, to see who would get the loans and who would get the scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
Just as primary care is the thing of the future, since you have a grant to study under it,
mm-hmm.
UMass is oriented anyway.
Right.
Toward primary care.
Yeah.
And that's the trend all over the country. They, according to all the reports and figures, there are too many specialists.
Right. I've heard the same.
And specialists are not going to be eliminated. but they're going to be curtailed very shortly.
Yeah.
And some of them are having trouble getting jobs already.
I've heard that too, yeah.
When we had the meeting this morning, one of our groups is a radiologist, and he said the way things are going, they have, for example, 12 radiologists in the group. This is Hanneman Memorial Day group. The way things are going in a year or two, he didn't know the time frame, that the kind of or the amount of work that's required because of technical advances will be able to be done by 3 radiologists.
As opposed to?
12.
Wow.
And he said that's nothing new, and he has friends around the country telling me in radiology, anesthesiology, did a finding. You know, you can't just go where you want, and it's not so easy to get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons is because of this whole emphasis on primary care, which is not only at UMass, you know, it's coming from Washington.
Yeah. How do you feel about that? Do you think that that's a direction that we should be moving in, or?
Well, in other words, I think you have to have a balance. You know, in all of this, can't go from one extreme to the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people who are trained, they just can't pick up and move into something else.
Right.
Although I read that some of the specialists are going back and getting primary care training just so they'll be in the swing of things. It's very disruptive, and maybe there are too many specialists, but one of the things that's at the root of all of this is to save money.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I'm not enough involved, you know, in the administration of the hospital to answer your question as to is it a good thing. It's really not a matter at the moment of whether it's good or not, because my voice isn't going to have much influence on what happens. What I'm more distressed about is what's happening in psychiatry. And that is, I don't know if you know this, but because of this whole managed care setup, psychotherapy, you perhaps have heard of that word, is being gradually eliminated.
In favor of?
Of nothing.
Really?
Well, the way it works is this. A patient comes in, you know, or is referred to me by the primary care doctor for psychotherapy. First of all, for me to see the patient, we have to get authorization. That's a sheet of paper which authorizes that visit through that healthcare system, say Central Mass, okay? So it's one visit. So what do you have to do then? So you see the patient, say he has panic disorder or depression, whatever it is. In order to see the patient, again, get permission, you have to fill out a form. It's not too complicated, but two sheets of paper or something like that to authorize more visits. Okay? Now, the patient, like with Central Mass, they're entitled to $500 per year of psychotherapy. That sounds simple. So you send the report in, and they come back and say, this patient can have 3 visits. 3 more. Now, that doesn't make $500.
Oh, it doesn't?
No. Well, how much do you think you get paid for a visit?
I don't know.
Well, whatever you put in, you don't get paid anyway.
Okay.
Every insurance company has a fixed amount.
Right.
And a lot of people have the idea that psychiatry is a wealthy profession. It isn't.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you know, it's on the lowest end of all medical specialties.
Oh. I didn't think it was one of the highest. I didn't know it was at the low end either.
It's equal to pediatrics.
Okay.
According to medical economics.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So here they're not even authorizing what the patient is entitled to. So in other words,
much less what they need.
That's incidental. They don't care what they
need.
So in other words, they're telling you, well, in 12 months, this patient can have 4 visits. Well, suppose a patient is, you know, severely depressed or suicidal, you know, in need of care, what are you supposed to do? So what they will do, then if you write to them again, and say the patient needs more care, they will authorize what's called medical treatment. I don't know if you know what that is.
Okay.
No. In other words, you can prescribe medicine
now,
like an antidepressant, but no consideration for talking to the patient.
Mm.
So this is why I say the psychotherapy, as far as the managed care companies are concerned, they just don't, they're not interested.
What kind of an effect do you think, or do you foresee that having?
Well, I think it has a profound effect both on the patient and the doctor as well. You know, this again points up what I mentioned before. Medical decisions, in this case psychiatric decisions, are being made by insurance companies,
mm-hmm.
not the doctor. So at the moment, you don't have any choice.
Right.
And I think that's pathetic. It's just like with other things, like with obstetrics, they tell you how long you can stay in the hospital after delivery, and with surgery, same
right.
kind of thing.
It seems almost that the pendulum has swung in the opposite, to the totally opposite pole, or is at least getting there.
From
the physician being able to make,
oh,
you know,
sure.
being
no
almost 100% or 100% autonomous in making all those decisions, to now being, having their hands very much tied. And it seems as if it's just kind of gone past any sense of reasonable.
No, you know, I think, I don't want you to get too discouraged.
Oh, no.
Because I know when I interview students, they're always very enthused and so forth and so forth. Sometimes I say to myself, maybe they're not realistic in terms of what to expect. But I don't think that's the case. I think, you know, you and people like in your period of life and training, you know, you've been brought up differently than we were. So the whole medical world is changing. So all of this represents a change. You know, medicine will always have a place, and there'll always be work to do. But it's changing very profoundly. And, you know, when you get involved in it, hopefully you will have your opportunity to do whatever you feel is best. And, you know, if you agree with things that are happening, you'll go along with them. If you don't agree, you might try to see that some changes are made.
You had mentioned before about the AMA, and you said that that was also something that you did not particularly agree with the direction that they were moving.
No, I don't. I belong. People say, why do you belong?
How long have you belonged?
Ever since I've been.
Okay. So it's a very different organization now than it was then.
No.
Oh, no?
No.
Oh, okay.
I belong mostly, or only, maybe, because it's really the only organized group that has national clout.
Is that still true, do you feel?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
What else? I don't know of anything else.
Well, I've heard that they don't have as much clout as they used to.
I don't know how you would measure that.
Okay.
It's always a very... Doctors are conservative by nature. They have to be. So this whole AMA is a very... Well, maybe that's, they have to be, but for example, 20 years ago, when they're talking about medical care, is it a privilege or is it a right? You know what the AMA used to say?
Probably a privilege.
Yes. It's ridiculous. You know, how can you, well, they finally came around to agreeing that everybody should have it. But they should be in the forefront of this, not in the rear end, if I can use that.
Yeah.
You know, not in the back trailing. And that's the way they've been in a lot of issues. And I feel, for example, with this whole question of who makes decisions, the AMA should be in the forefront, fighting to see that we get back some measure of control. Not easy. I can see the problem. I don't know what the answers are, but I don't see that happening because every doctor you know, is just they're looking out for each other, for themselves, looking out for the welfare of doctors in general, or for the community health. Mm-hmm. You see in the newspaper. You see in the newspaper more things about health care is buying out Central Mass for $26 million until, you know, that's not, that's business, that's not medicine. And then, Blue Cross and Blue Shield are always raising their rate. I just got my bill for Medex. It's a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, fortunately, I have it. And I talked to my wife about it. I said, you know, this is ridiculous to pay this much. Maybe we should look into another plan. And she had an interesting answer. She said, well, this way, I can go to any doctor I want. And you can, too. The other way will be limited.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we can do that because I have the asset, but everybody can't do that.
Right, right.
And that's, you know, I think, kind of sad.
How long have you been interviewing students for the medical school? Kind of change gears here.
I'm not sure, maybe 4 or 5 years. Do you know Dr. Bernhardt? He's head of the dermatology.
Oh, no.
And he used to be chairman.
Jeff Bernhardt, yes, I do. Of course I know him. Every time I see him in the halls, you know, he signed my admissions letter, so it's like, you know, thank you.
And he was on the scholarship committee, raising money. And so we've always been friendly. About 4 or 5 years ago, he said, how would you like to do this? I said, sure, I'd like to. He thought I might add a little different perspective, being a psychiatrist. I might be able to weed out, you know, potential psychotic. The first class, you know, joking about it, 1970, there were 16 students.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you won't believe this, but I did. One became psychotic and ended up in St. Vincent on our closed unit.
Oh, my.
And a second turned out to be an epileptic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's nothing wrong with being an epileptic as long as it's not going to interfere with your work.
Right.
But this one was very complicated with some personality problems involved. So that as a result, now this is 2 out of 16, that's 12.5%. They decided for a while to put a psychiatrist that wasn't made this way back to see if they could, you know, be more effective in screening.
Wow.
Who wasn't or wasn't. Anyway, that's not why I'm a Jeff just asked if I'd be, and I like to do the work, and it's interesting you get to meet the students and see what's going on, and see, I feel encouraged by the kind of people we meet, both men and women. You know, 50% of the classes here are now young ladies.
Yeah.
I feel encouraged by the people that are going to take over medicine. You know, that means you and other people. I feel very confident about the future. In spite of all these problems, I don't know, maybe it may sound more negative than positive about what I'm telling you. You know, about these problems.
Right. Oh, no, I mean, I think my perspective, I think the problems are there. And, I mean, yeah, you know, we do have to obviously work to solve them, but, I mean, they are there, and they do have to be dealt with, you know.
I think, so you understand where I'm coming from, I feel you can't be in a better kind of work, so to speak, than medicine. What other opportunity can you have, first of all, to do some good? You don't cure everybody, but you're doing something useful. It's a respected profession. There'll always be people that need your attention and your care. And I don't know what else you can ask for. How many people do you find in life that are really satisfied and happy with what they're doing? I don't know. You'll find out.
Yeah, I know.
You'll find out it's not an awful lot.
Really? Do you think most doctors are satisfied?
A lot are.
Really? Is that different now than you think from when you were?
No, I don't think
so. Oh, okay, so it's not like medicine is any different from...
Well, medicine is completely different.
Well, I mean, in the session, how people feel about it being in it.
I hear, you know, because I've been around for 50 years, mm-hmm. more negative thinking because of all these involvements with the healthcare system, insurance companies, and so forth. But I can tell you, even in the years gone by, you know, you could get complainers.
Sure.
And if it wasn't this, it's something else. And so that's true, but it's still, you know, medicine is a wonderful profession. And, I'm counting on you to keep it going.
I'm glad to hear somebody who's upbeat about it, because I have also heard from, you know, other doctors just in coming along my way who, you know, they don't know if they would recommend the profession to people or, you know, I mean, I've had some people, you know, oh, you're going into medicine, you know, why do you want to do that? I mean, you know, with the emphasis on, you know, you shouldn't be, you know, do, you know, it's easier to make a living doing other things and, but like you say, I think medicine offers a unique blend of rewards and challenges that, you know, you just don't find anywhere else. And, you know, I mean, nobody goes into this for money anymore, you know, and you do it for other reasons, and there are going to be problems and stumbling blocks no matter what profession you go into.
Well, you always make a living in medicine, one way or the other.
Yeah.
But there are more restrictions on what you do, where you go, and so forth and so forth. And that's the way it seems to me.
I guess one other thing that I wanted to ask you about and kind of get your opinion on was, and you actually brought up at the beginning of the interview about the litigious nature of society. And, you know, I guess just to throw out a couple of questions, you know, has it always been that way? Is it more so now as opposed to when you were first practicing?
And
if so, how do you feel that that has impacted the practice of medicine and the balance of medicine?
When I was in medical school, I remember saying, gee, we ought to have a few lectures on the legal aspects of medicine. So, and somebody would give one or two lectures, and they were not of much value. Now, doctors are required to take courses in risk management. Are you familiar with that?
I mean, I've heard of risk management. I'm not familiar that they're required to take courses.
Oh, yes. To get your license, you have to put in 10 hours mm-hmm. every 2 years. What is risk management? I took a course by mail. It was a very good course on how to avoid getting sued. That's what it really boiled down to. But a lot, you know, I had to take written exams to get just to get credit for the course, and it was worthwhile. Years ago, you never heard of that. You never think of that. And nowadays, because society is so litigious, and you have to be concerned about malpractice suits, how to avoid them. That's one of the basic things with risk management.
Something you never saw 30, 40 years ago.
No. And, you know, as you know, malpractice premiums are incredible. Not for us, because we're among the lowest, because we're the lowest wage earners. But surgeons, you know what they pay? I don't know if you're aware.
No.
An obstetrician, depending on where you are, $50,000 to $75,000 per year.
Really? That's a lot.
Look at all the work you have to do just to pay it.
Right.
And also, if you start practice, say you're the surgeon, you can't open your door. That's why a lot of doctors are going into groups.
Which provide that coverage?
Oh, yes, sure. That's like the family clinic or any. So, you know, the society is trying to do something about putting limits on the amount that suits the amount that a person can try to sue for, and screening out a lot of these things, but it's, I shouldn't ask you, but you probably have watched the O.J. Simpson case.
Yeah, I've seen a little bit of it.
Every person in there, for example, every witness who comes up has a lawyer. I don't know if you're aware of that.
No, no, I didn't.
Everyone has a lawyer. I think that's incredible. You know, this Detective Furman,
mm-hmm.
he has a high-priced lawyer. And everyone who comes up there, I think it's almost ludicrous. Anyway, that's the way it is. That's the law. So, it's a problem in medicine. And as a result, to try to avoid this, a lot of, for example, examinations and laboratory work is done, which really is not medically necessary, but is done more as what we call defensive medicine.
Do you have any theories or, you know, what you feel about why it has gotten to this point as far as having to have that malpractice insurance?
I think it's more of a social problem. It's not just medicine, you know. Our society has just become very litigious. You name it, people will sue at the drop of a hat. I'm surprised that I haven't been sued.
Oh, you never have?
Never.
That's excellent.
Well, so far.
It's weird that we should even be saying something like that, you know, because...
That's right.
You should not be, you know. I mean, if you're practicing medicine, you know,
you
in a proper manner, you should write.
But you never know. And a psychiatrist is sued just as well as medical people and surgical people.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot has to do with how you treat and relate to your patients. If you treat them well, you know, as human beings, and all doctors don't, it makes a difference. Like, let me give you an example. I have a friend who was found to have cancer of the prostate. Okay? So he had major surgery in Boston. You know, there are two ways of treating it. The one not transurethral, I don't know if you've gotten to that, but he had the whole prostate removed. It's a big job. And for a couple of years, everything was fine. Then are you familiar with the PSA, the prostatic specific antigen?
The blood test.
Okay. His started going up. It was very low, but it started going up. So he went to the doctor. Anyway, to make a long story short, this is a doctor in Boston. I told him he could do this, have the same thing done in Worcester. He didn't have to go to Boston. One day he called up to make an appointment, and the secretary, not the doctor, he wouldn't come to the phone, said, the doctor thinks you should have radiation because your PSA is starting to go up.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get the doctor to the phone. Well, how do you... And he told me he was so upset.
Yeah.
And, you know, the doctor even didn't have the courtesy or the time or the interest. In addition to everything, he told me something. He said, you know, during the couple of years he was under treatment, he gave a lot of money to the hospital.
Oh, God.
So, on top of everything, which shouldn't be a factor, but when you're treated like that, it leaves a bad feeling.
Yeah.
So, what he did, and I had suggested to him, you can have radiation done in Worcester, you don't have to go to Boston. It's a drag, you know, to go 35 times back and forth and back. So he wasn't about to sue them or anything like that, but this is the kind of thing that leads. So,
yeah, that's one thing I've heard. I can't remember whether it was in a study or just anecdotal evidence that basically the doctors who get sued, or the biggest predictor for getting sued is the relationship you have with the patients.
No question.
You know, the doctors who get along well with their patients and have a very good patient rapport don't get sued. Very rarely get sued, I should say. You know?
But you never know. Well, I usually don't talk this much, but I don't have the opportunity. So I don't know if this information is is or isn't of any value.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, just, you know, just to hear your thoughts and, you know, like I said, I mean, you've got so much experience and just to hear what you know, have to say about medicine and how you feel things are going. And is there anything else you wanted to bring up? Or?
No, the only other thing is I wish, and it won't happen, that I'd be around 25 years from now so I could see what's happening in the world of medicine, but I don't. As a matter of fact, see this necktie?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, what I'm laughing is I bought it over the weekend. There was a sale at Pauline's Basement in Hyannis. I don't even want to tell you how much these cost. It's very little.
Uh-huh.
But I saw three neckties, you know, kind of bright, flashy. And I put one on this morning. And my wife said, what are you putting on this new cheerful tie? I said, well, I don't know how long I'm going to last. Love it up while I have a chance. So that's
Well, hopefully you're around for a few years, definitely, to see what happens.
Well, I know what the statistics are, and I'm just fortunate that I lasted this long.
Yeah. It's fortunate for all of us, I think.
Well, I don't know about that, but at least. So, anyway, I can see you're going to do well in your career. If there's anything I can do for you, you know, because I work in the EEG lab at the school.
Okay.
I don't know if you knew that.
No, I didn't.
Yeah. I have a title. I'm Associate Professor of Neurology.
Oh, I didn't know that either. Do you teach?
Yeah.
Okay.
I teach the residents, EEG work.
Oh.
I used to teach psychiatry for the first 10 or 12 years.
Okay.
They used to come up to St. Vincent, and then the lab asked me to work in the EEG lab because they were short of people, and I started working, and I'm still there.
Yeah,
I like it.
Yeah, I'll have to come up and see you sometime.
Down, it's level A.
Oh, it is, okay.
You know where that is?
Yep. Oh, yeah.
Sure, anytime.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right.
It's been very interesting. I enjoyed it. Definitely encouraged me to do another one.